Hello everyone, this is Andy Steele, host of 9/11 Freefall. I just wanted to give you a quick programming note at the onset of tonight's episode. We're going to be experimenting with a new half-hour-long format starting tonight. Now the hope is that we can give you a more concise, impactful listening experience and get right to the important points in each interview. So we're going to see how it goes for a few weeks, and if it works, then great, and if not, then no harm done. Please let me know what you think of the new format via the contact box on 911freefall.com. I'm interested to know. And so with all of that said, enjoy the show.
The views expressed on this show by guests and the hosts on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth.
I am joined today by Christopher Emery. He's got a company called Free Mind Films, which is behind such movies as A Noble Lie, which talks about the Oklahoma City bombing. We'll be getting into that today. And State of Mind, Psychology of Control, an issue I am very interested in, as our audience may be well aware. We'll be talking about these films today and how some of this, the elements involved in the subjects that are covered in those films relate to our work here in the 9/11 Truth Movement. But first, I just want to say, Christopher Emery, welcome to 9/11 Freefall.
Well, thank you, Andy. I appreciate you inviting me on. It's an honor to be here.
So I want our audience to know you a little better. Take a few minutes and tell us about yourself and how did you get into researching these topics that look into the alternative information to what we're told on television about these important events.
Okay, well, first of all, I guess I could point them to my imdb.com profile. It's under Christopher Emery, Roman numeral 2. There are other couple of Christopher Emerys, but it'll give them a pretty good idea of what I've been up to. I've been in radio, television, and film for 40 years. I worked as a freelance photographer with Big Ten football, did a handful of games at the NFL, and that was for 8.5 years, and then I met a lot of colleagues on the sidelines that were actually in radio, television, and film, and I thought that'd be a great career to pursue. I was very good at the photography and knew public relations end pretty well, but my forte is actually working behind the camera, and what I became really good at was bringing together the director of photography, the lighting, the audio crew, and the post production crew, and then being able to market the films, doing the investor relations. So basically getting the complete project turnkey ready to go. But if I may make just a slight correction on the title of our film with Oklahoma City, it's called A Noble Lie, Oklahoma City, 1995. Not to be confused with A Noble Lie, which coincidentally was written and produced and directed by Richard Grove, who we actually interviewed in our second film. He helped us co-write State of Mind, Psychology of Control. So all three of our films are actually available on Amazon Prime. And they've been on there for about a year, almost a year and a half, and it's freemindfilms.com. So that's pretty much it in a nutshell.
Please tell us about your Oklahoma City film. Now, I don't know, was this your first film that you had made challenging an official narrative?
That's correct. I worked for a small production studio in Fort Worth, Texas for about a year and a half. We did biographical documentaries, anything from 25 minutes to maybe 40 minutes long. But the opportunity came up. A friend of mine that had known that I'd worked on some other information, including the downing of Flight TWA-800, was actually shot down by the U.S. Navy. But that's another interview for another time. And he knew that I was asked to step away from that case for personal and business reasons. And he said, look, I have nearly 3 hours of raw, unedited, three-quarter-inch Betamaster footage. This is before digital. This is back in 1998, he approached me. And this was shot by the Stringer photographers that were actually in downtown Oklahoma City the morning of the bombing. They were actually covering a prayer breakfast that was attended by the governor and the mayor and a lot of the aldermen and the pastors and the rabbis, the clergy, members of the clergy, and basically the political movers and shakers in Oklahoma City. They were six blocks away from where the bombing took place. and they had their cameras rolling at about 8:30 during the prayer breakfast. All heck broke loose at 9:02 a.m., and they literally rushed up there, ran up there with the satellite trucks and their crew, and started rolling footage. What I saw was the unedited raw footage that CBS, NBC, ABC, and CNN, the flagship stations, no way they could run that up the satellite uplink. They didn't have time to vet it. And after watching that in his living room for the better part of 3 hours, I looked at him and I said, Jerry, this thing completely destroys the official narrative. There's nothing here that supports the case. I mean, the official story that we were told. And so I set out for the next 6 months to figure out how to at least put an outline together of what we could do to portray a truthful, you know, portrayal of the case versus what we had on the official narrative. And went back to my boss at the small studio that I was working in Fort Worth, and he said, look, you give yourself 6 months or $6,000. Whatever you burn through first, you have to decide which direction you want to move. And it took me about 3 months to figure out, yeah, there's nothing that supports the official narrative. And I just started, like I said, putting the outline together. It took me about a year and a half trying to figure out the funding. And I moved to Oklahoma City from Fort Worth, Texas, to start work on the case. And it was a labor of love for 8.5 years. 75 people helped us out on that film. Core group of 15, and then there were 7 of us principals on the film crew. And we had to self-fund it. And the result was we were very proud of what we released. And even our colleagues had commended us with several awards. And we never looked back. To this day, every week, I still get emails or a phone call or maybe a text regarding the case. So,
well, that's amazing. And the fact that you actually changed your residence, moving down to Oklahoma City, you were so dedicated to put this film together. There must have been some really compelling stuff when you were looking at the raw footage. Now, I know your film is out there and our audience can go out there and view it, and I urge them to do that. But can you go over some of the information that compelled you to make this bold move and put yourself so fully into this project? What were some of the things that were covered in your film that we didn't hear about in the news?
Well, back up before I even moved to Oklahoma City, and I did that in January of 2003. In June of 2001, we're talking, 3 months before 9/11 even occurred, and here again we're going to do the tie-ins to 9/11 truth, and there's a lot of overlaps, intended or unintended. It's unbelievable. But there was an independent investigation committee called the Oklahoma Bombing Investigation Committee. I'm looking at their final report right now. It's 572 pages. Excuse me, I take that. Yeah, 572 pages, over 80 pages of photographs. That it was a former state legislator by the name of Charles Key. His former secretary at the state capitol was killed in the Murrah building that morning. She had quit the state capitol, worked for the federal government for a year, and was there the morning of the bombing and unfortunately had perished. There was a retired Air Force colonel, George Wallace, is a member of the committee. He was an expert in ballistics, and he was a fighter pilot in the Korean War and the early stages of the Vietnam War. He knew what ballistics could do and what they couldn't do. And then a survivor, V.Z. Lawton, who was on the 8th floor of the building that morning, came within an inch of his life. Several of his colleagues and co-workers and friends were killed in the bombing. And then a multimillionaire in the insurance business in Oklahoma City that really got fed up with seeing Charles Key get paddled on the television and beat up in the papers for 2.5 years. He was ostracized and called a conspiracy theorist. That's the farthest thing from the truth. I mean, I've known Charles for the better part of 19 years, and he's about as level-headed and as even-keeled as you can get. And he was asked by his constituents, he's in District 90 in the west side of Oklahoma City. A lot of his constituents had either family members or friends or loved ones that were either injured, severely injured, or killed in that bombing. And they said, look, just find out what happened. We're getting one story from the Oklahoma City Police Department, something different from the Oklahoma County Sheriff's, and different from the Oklahoma Highway Patrol. And then the FBI has just given us a cock and bull story that makes absolutely no sense. And they were, I mean, his phone was blowing up at the office. His cell phone was blowing up. He was getting emails. He said, please, just help us sort this out. We want to know what happened to our loved ones. And that was it. When I met him in June of 2001, I never looked back. And he was just, he was the bellwether. He's, to this day, he's still my guide on the case in a lot of ways. But he was our consultant on the film, and he helped bring together the volunteers and the private investigators and the retired military, local, county, state, and federal law enforcement, search and rescue. people that kind of doubted what we were going to be doing at first, but one by one, the victims' family members and survivors came forward. All in all, we interviewed 326 people for the film. Obviously, we couldn't put them all in, you know, in the film. We had a total runtime of 2 hours, even though we shot 6.5 hours of footage. But he helped us put together, I'd say, probably 95% of the names on that list. And, in fact, I'm going to fly up there. You know, I'm currently residing in Florida, but I'm flying up there for the 25-year commemoration anniversary. I'm going to join him and several of our friends that worked on the film for dinner. And so it'll be good to see them for at least 2 or 3 days.
All right. Now, I have not studied Oklahoma City as in-depth as I have 9/11. One thing I do remember, and maybe you can talk about this, there was some footage from that day of various reporters talking about another explosive device that hadn't exploded yet being taken out of the scene. And then the only time I ever heard that was online when they were playing this footage from that day, but you never heard anything about that from the news when it was going on. Could you talk about that?
Absolutely. In fact, Devin Scillian was the he was with NBC Channel 4. He had already taken a job with the NBC 4 in Detroit with NBC. And he was in Oklahoma City to finish up his contractual obligation with Channel 4 in Oklahoma City. He was the PM anchor, so he was actually in bed when the explosion happened. I had a chance to meet with him back in 2007 when he was working in Detroit, and he told me that it was the first time in the history of Channel 4 and NBC there in Oklahoma City that both the AM and the PM anchors, the A-teams from both shifts, were working together to break the story. And they were actually getting the, within the first 4 hours after the bombing, they were getting their intel coming in from the governor's office, from the Oklahoma Highway Patrol, the county sheriffs, and the Oklahoma City Police Department. Once again, you have to remember the context. These people, all of the law enforcement, their loved ones, and some of their family members and friends who were killed in the bombing, they wanted to find out what was going on, I mean, from the get-go. There was no obfuscation, no, you know, glossing this thing over. So the intel that was coming into the television station, he told me, was yes, that was accurate. There were unexploded devices in the building. The Oklahoma County Sheriff's bomb squad was in there trying to recover them and get them out to a gun range 10 miles outside of town. There were bomb squad trucks and, you know, special containers in the back of the trucks that were specifically designed for that purpose. Lo and behold, the FBI, both from Dallas, from Washington, D.C., and other field offices, not in Oklahoma City, but from outlying states, one by one, within 4 hours, they're coming in and telling these guys, the agencies I just mentioned to you, how to do their job. Bad, bad mistake. And that continued to have an undertow even when I moved to Oklahoma City 8 years after the fact. That's why when we were starting to make the film, they wanted to come to us and tell us what happened, with the truth about what happened that morning. But they couldn't for various reasons, whether it be political reasons or career or their pensions were on the line. And, you know, some of them were threatened with their jobs and even other things. But to get back to that story, yes, that was true. And what we found out, of all people, a retired medic from the Oklahoma County Sheriff's Department and the bomb squad said, yes, there were actually 23 devices in that building. Not one or two or five, but 23. Three of them went off. And it was the other 20 that the FBI didn't want the public to know about. And that intel came into the governor's office, and the story was shut down. Within 4 hours, Devin Scillian told me, it's like you saw this veil just go over every single thing that was coming in the newsroom. His news director, Melissa Klinzing, was very upset. She said, that's not how we run a television station. You're not going to be giving us stuff that's complete cock and bull. We've never done that, and we're not going to do it. And they pretty much told her to be quiet. Well, she was stubborn. For the next 2 years, she was able to leak out some of that information. And then her contract simply was not renewed. New York Times came in and bought him in, but that's another story for another time. But, yes, you hit the nail on the head. 23 devices were in that building that morning, live, ready to go off with custom-made mercury switches. Had nothing to do with the ANFO truck driving up in front of the building, which actually exploded 5 to 8 seconds after the building was coming down. So that whole story, and like I said, even before I moved to Oklahoma City, once I knew that that story made absolutely no sense, I knew that we were on the right direction to make a film. We just had to figure out how to do it and where to get the information from and triple-check our facts before we started putting it on film and doing the interviews.
Right, and there also I was it was brought to my attention, there was a person named Terrence Yakey, who was murdered, and he was also harassed for, he was like one of the first patrolmen down there, and he's actually a hero on the scene that day, but he was harassed, intimidated, and he ended up getting murdered. Can you tell our audience a little bit about that?
Absolutely. In fact, before we even started interviewing, and I moved to Oklahoma City in January of 2003, I met his mother. At the time, grandmother was 82, and his two sisters, former sister-in-law and a couple of brother-in-laws, and we sat down in the living room of his mom's house, small town outside of Oklahoma City, about 40 miles away. And I told them from that first meeting, I says, I'm going to make a feature-length film, and we're going to get at least 8 to 12 minutes to telling Terry's story, what happened. Runtime on his segment was 8 minutes and 2 seconds. We came in exactly where we wanted to be. But he was the first Oklahoma City police officer on the scene of the crime. He was issuing a traffic ticket 4 blocks away at the Civic Center Music Hall. His squad car jumped in his black and white squad car. In fact, I talked to the gal he was issuing the ticket to several years later, obviously, and she said, yeah, he dropped his ticket book right there on the pavement, jumped into the car, and sped up to the crime scene, pulled out 8 people. Now, mind you, he stands about, I believe he was between 6'6", 6'7". The guy weighed a solid 275 pounds, big guy. He pulled 8 people out of the rubble within the next 3 hours, exhausted. And he had a bad back to boot. He was just due for back surgery, but he didn't let that get in the way. Lieutenant Joanne Randall. I'm going to start popping out names here. And if these people have an exception to this, we know who they are. They're welcome to call me, and then I'm going to call them on their bluff. Lieutenant Joanne Randall was his commanding officer. He was going to submit a 14-page report of what happened that morning. She told him, in no uncertain terms, to cut it down to 3.5 pages. And he pretty much told her to take a flying leap. He said he wasn't going to lie about what he saw that morning. So for the next year and a half, the bombing happens actually in April of 95. He was murdered on May 8 of 1996, so it was a little over a year later. He was brutally murdered, found laying 3 miles in a farm field, 3 miles from the federal penitentiary. It was about 35 miles west of downtown Oklahoma City. And it was because we believe, and all of the information, the people that saw him within days and hours and minutes before his body, he perished in that farm field. They said that he knew what happened. He had the intel hidden in a storage locker, not far from where he was run off the road. And several of his colleagues in the Oklahoma County Sheriff's Department, friends of his that knew him, and the police department knew that he was murdered. And it was a sign to basically tell everybody else to shut up. And it was done by a third party. We had a source at the U.S. Prosecutor's Office in downtown Oklahoma City that pretty much gave us one-page summary of what they knew. This is coming from the U.S. Prosecutor's Office. This isn't Bush League. This isn't hearsay. This isn't conjecture or rumor. This is solid facts that we were able to review. Eyes only. We weren't able to reprint it. We weren't able to put it on the film. And that was the word that we gave them. But we saw it. And it clearly showed that there was a third party hired in, similar to what the CIA would do. It wasn't the CIA, but it was similar to them, to come in and do the dirty work, get it done, and they left town before anybody even knew what happened. They found his body 6 hours later. And the police department was told to cover it up. So, yes, that's true. And we tried to at least cover that information for 8 minutes in the film. And to this day, I mean, I still get teary-eyed when I look at the intel. We were able to petition and sue the state medical examiner's office. Sue was not the right word. I mean, they were very gracious about giving us the information. We just had to go through the proper channels. And I sat down with his mom almost 4 years, after we started working on the film. And I sat down with her at her kitchen table. We went through every page of that report. And we saw a couple of the photos. And they were given a full autopsy, which is really strange. And he died because of a good cause. He did not want to take that truth to his death. He wanted it to come out. And there were certain functionaries and certain powers within the police department that pretty much were told, given their marching orders, and told to have him shut up or obfuscate the report, and he refused to do that.
It's fascinating because Oklahoma City happened so long ago, even longer than September 11th, yet you continue on this issue. You come on and do interviews about it like we're doing right now. And I imagine there must have been some resistance to your film coming out. Now, we're seeing the internet get neutered in the sense that it's hard to find 9/11 truth videos out there on Google and on YouTube. They're closing the window with which you can show people this information. You can see the strangling happening here. How did you manage to fight any kind of resistance and get your video or your movie out in front of as many people as you could?
Well, that's a good question. And by the way, once again, this April 19 will be 25 years. It did happen. And I remember clear as a bell. It's like the JFK assassination. You know, what was I doing that morning? But to answer your question, it basically coming in from a lot of different directions. You're correct. Digital was just coming on. It had been in place probably digital media for about, I want to say, 3 or 4 years when we released the film. I mean, this is at a competent level, not just hodgepodge, but a competent level. We released it in December, the first week of December in 2011. DVDs, believe it or not, were still all the rage. I mean, you know, 60% of our sales for that first 4 years were DVDs. And then we tried to get on video on demand. You know, most of our revenue was coming from DVDs. We did have a couple of prominent radio show hosts help us, huge audience. In fact, he was interviewed in the film, both our first and second films. So to answer your question, we were very lucky to get within that window before all of this censoring and what YouTube and Google are doing now. We completely missed that. That was not in place. They did not have the infrastructure to pull that malarkey on us. And luckily, we were able to get on board with Amazon Prime in March of 2018. So it's coming up on this next month. It'll be 2 years we've been online with them. They have really rolled out the red carpet, so to speak, and still it's available, has not been expunged. To flip that question, we did get on with Netflix. They vetted our film, Oklahoma City Film, for 42 days. We were on their portfolio for 3 days, and it was yanked after 3 days, which makes absolutely no sense. Why would they spend the time and the resources for 42 days to vet our film and then all of a sudden just take it off 3 days afterwards? They don't work like that. That's not Netflix. We found out from our agent, this is our second film agent in L.A., that a couple of things happened. Viable options, we don't know for sure, but this we think that either somebody from the Justice Department or somebody from the White House called Netflix and told them to pull our film. All the while that there were at least two other films on there supporting the official narrative. It's not that we didn't have the facts straight. If we didn't, they could have cared less. So, as the radio show host once said, once you know you're over the target and they're shooting at you, you know you're doing the right thing because you're on the spot. You've got them in the proverbial crosshairs. They didn't want that to happen, so Netflix dumped us after 3 days on their portfolio. So we told that whole story to a rep with our film agent, our current film agent, doing a wonderful job for us out of L.A. He relayed that to Amazon, and Amazon said, "Hey, no problem." And within 5 days, we're online with them. Everything was already vetted. All of our copyrights are in order with all three of our films, the Library of Congress. We had all of the paperwork in order. So they just took us on without even batting an eye. And we're very, very appreciative of that. So anyway, that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, that is pretty cheesy that they would take so long to edit it over 40 days and then leave the film up for only 3 days. You know there had to be some intervention at some point. Somebody was not very happy. So I want to talk about your other film while we still got the time to do it. It's called State of Mind, Psychology of Control. Now, I have not watched this one yet, but I love the title of it, and it's definitely what is going on in our modern society. So can you give our audience a little preview and talk about some of the elements that you discuss in that film?
Sure. By the way, I do want to acknowledge that I wasn't the only one producing these films. I was a co-producer. I was very blessed to have the opportunity to narrate Oklahoma City, Novel Lie, Oklahoma City 95. And I helped co-produce all three films and basically was in charge of logistics and project manager. So Richard Grove, once again, helped us co-write and did an absolutely wonderful job of helping us put the pieces together after we had some of the guys had to leave for personal reasons. He came back on board and really helped us with that film. We interviewed him in the film. Richard was a survivor of 9/11. He almost got killed that morning. He'd worked in one of the Twin Towers. His financial office is one of them. So, again, the overlap to 9/11. And he told us quite a bit about what happened that morning. So, anyway, what it is, it's a primer. And all of our films aren't the end-all, be-all. They're primers to give the audience the information and have them decide for themselves. The State of Mind, Psychology of Control, we interview out of the wish list of 28 people. I think we were able to interview 26. These are the experts, peer-reviewed authors, professional lecturers and in some cases academia that basically gave us the day we're born till the day we die, how we are influenced either through media or education or the economics or nutrition or various factions of the U.S. government, whether it be intentional or unintentional, overt or covert. And it gives us, you're able to step back and look at the bigger picture of what's going on in our lives on a daily basis. And this is especially germane to the younger generation. And I know I'm sounding like my dad, but let's face it, with the technology and the IT and everything, the younger generation is simply overwhelmed. They're in sensory overload most of the time. They don't have a chance to step back and look at the context and the bigger picture of what's going on. This film is one of many out there, but we're very proud that we're able to take the time and have the resources to give the audience a context of what's going on and how to decide for themselves. Okay, it's one thing to have the information. It's something else completely to say, okay, at least I have the info. What can I do to correct the path that I'm on? Do I want to continue to be influenced or, you know, be stuck in this vortex of believing one thing when something else is happening? So that was, you know, we were recognized by both liberal and conservative colleges and high schools throughout the U.S. and Canada for our efforts. And so we were very, very proud to have the opportunity to release that. Shattering is our third film. It's more of a macrocosm of world history from the Spanish-American War right through just before the first Persian Gulf War. And again, the context of why our war started, who stands to lose, who stands to gain, and who is profiting. You know, the war profiteers that are funding both sides. We go all the way from Teddy Roosevelt to the setup on the USS Maine explosion to Pearl Harbor. Horrendous, horrendous miscarriage of justice on the Pearl Harbor case with Theodore Roosevelt, or Franklin Roosevelt, excuse me, getting the intel 10 days before Pearl Harbor happened. And he sat on it, knowing that the Japanese would be provoked into attacking Pearl Harbor. And that was basically our end to World War II to help out the Allies in Europe. Regardless of the fact that over 2,300 Marine civilian and servicemen were killed in Pearl Harbor that morning. And then they had his war secretary, Secretary of War, had the audacity to bring up General Short and Admiral Kimmel on charges in conspiracy and dereliction of duty. And they were going to court-martial them and throw them in prison. That was the farthest thing from the truth. It was a congressional hearing that saved their and exposed the truth and saved their back end 2 years later. And they were exonerated of all charges. So we cover that in the film. So anyway, that's our efforts, and we're very proud of the work that we've done.
Absolutely, as well you should be. I think anybody out there that is casting a light on major historical events and bringing valid arguments to make people question them deserves a special place in the history books, everybody involved. Now, in our last 2 minutes here, can you tell our audience how they can get your films? I mean, there's Amazon Prime. I imagine there's other ways, too. Tell them how to find you guys.
Well, it's actually just log on to our website, freemindfilms.com, and we just narrowed it down to basically two pages on there. Very simple website. When you log on there, you're going to see all three movie posters for our films, one for each. You click onto the movie poster. It's a hyperlink right to Amazon Prime. And then it gives you the option to rent, to watch the trailers, to buy. There's five or six different options. We would certainly appreciate the support. That helps us fund our future projects and pay back our investors and so forth. And so thank you, Andy, and would love to come back on if you want to talk about any other subjects.
Well, Christopher Emery, good luck in all of your endeavors and your future projects, which I imagine you'll probably have new topics come up. And thank you so much for coming on 9/11 Freefall today.
You're welcome, and I'll be in touch, Andy. Have a great day.
This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific, and every other Sunday night on BBS Radio at 8 o'clock Eastern, 5 o'clock Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele. Say have a great week. Good luck.